and Piraeus to look at also how can we approach the kind of global economy in terms of the shift from the West to the East and so on. But my work in Algeciras at the southern part of Spain by the Strait of Gibraltar has mainly centered on kind of issues of labor and logistics in the port. So when I usually talk about this project, those are kinds of issues that I would talk about. I would talk about the dock workers that I've been following in the port. I would also talk about what is logistics work, logistics temporalities, and so on and so forth. So I'm very happy to talk about any of those issues also in the Q&A. But I thought that I would actually zoom out a bit today and take a kind of broader look at the port, both as a port, but also as a specific kind of location, also as a kind of hint at Sarah's own work here, I think. So that is the plan I have for today. And let's see for the next 40 minutes where that takes us. I will try and share my screen and show you some photographs along the way. Here we are. Let's see. Yeah, here we are. So the port we visited then. But first of all, I thought that I would not go to southern Spain, but instead start somewhere else. And more specifically, I would like to start in Korea, in South Korea. Because in April 2020, the South Korean shipping company Hyundai Merchant Marine held a naming ceremony for the new container ship at the shipyard in Goje in Korea. And the ship was this one, the HHM Algeciras, 400 meters long, the size of approximately 3 soccer fields, with room for up to 24,000 of these shipping containers that you can see on the photograph here. And this naming ceremony of this container giant was celebrated not only in Korea, but also on a coastline quite far from Korea. Because in the port of Algeciras Bay, located in southern Spain then, this port was actually initially not among the regular stops that was planned for this vessel that was carrying its name, but eventually eventually the vessel made it to Algeciras as well. So the photograph that you can see on the screen here is taken earlier this year when the ship finally made it to the town that has given her name. And the celebration of the HHM Algeciras in the town of Algeciras was perhaps more most clearly expressed by the town's mayor, because José Ignacio Landaluce, who's the Conservative People's Party mayor, actually wrote a letter to the CEO of HMM saying that the HHM Algeciras would help to enlarge, boost, and empower the international image of Algeciras as a town. And perhaps for a town that lies at the gateway between Europe and Africa, that's struggling with high unemployment rates, illicit economies, and a bad public image, this ship was seen as a kind of important recognition of this port town's global importance. The HHM Algeciras and the size you can see here, this mega, mega ship, is now at this moment still the world's largest container ship, something that I've written on together with Elizabeth Schober earlier this year. And what you see on the screen here, yeah, it's not a very, very good photograph, but what you can see here is the kind of sizing or the growth of container ships from the 1960s to 2020. And what we can see here is that from 2005 to 2015, these container ships actually doubled in size and they've just continued growing. So now we're up to these mega, mega ships such as the Algeciras, which can carry, as I said, 24,000 containers on its back. And in Algeciras, these mega ships are often described as, Asiáticos, Koreanos, or Chinos due to where they have been built, usually in South Korea or China. And yet the connection that is made between Asian and the megaship here reflect also this larger shift in global shipping, where the center of gravity here has moved gradually eastwards. So in parallel with the technological advances and transformations of shipping, Western Europe has gradually lost its historical hegemony due to increased international competition, with East Asian nations now controlling a growing part of the market shares. But in Algeciras, like in many other ports, a broadly conceptualized Asian here equals the present and the future of shipping expressed through this gigantism, or gigantismo, which is called in Spanish. So the size of the HMM Algeciras that we see on this photograph is, of course, somehow emblematic of this ship growth that has been making an impact on labor, on infrastructure, and on territories. And the question of vessel size, of course, brings us from this port in southern Spain out to other central networks of maritime gateways around the world. We can think of the Panama Canal. We can think about the Suez Canal that was blocked up earlier this year. So when a ship like this arrives in Algeciras, like we can see on the photograph here, the capacity of receiving these high numbers of these kinds of megaships is looked upon as a kind of collective achievement and regarded also as important for the future of a port. Not only for a public port authority that has taken this photograph we can see in front of us, but also for the workers, such as the dock workers, that every time a megaship arrives to the port will post photographs, some spectacular photographs on Facebook and other social media platforms, celebrating the capacity of the worker force to receive these forms of floating giants. So the Algeciras megaship here is a kind of starting point to launch some of the central questions that I ask in this ongoing work, that how is actually cargo circulation achieved and contested in a time of global shipping? And the context of this megaship inauguration here and the journey of this megaship is perhaps quite familiar for many of you already, as maritime research never gets tired of reminding us. Around 100,000 cargo ships operate the world's oceans. There are still these central highways for transporting 90% of all our raw materials and consumer goods. So supply chain capitalism spanning the last 60 years and the proliferation of global logistics, of course, fundamentally transformed long distance maritime trade. And researchers from various disciplines have recounted the history of technological standardization, containerization, and pointed to also the shipping container a central role as a driver for these globalization processes. It is also the case that we've seen recently excellent historical and ethnographic work that has revealed and engaged with the role of global shipping for the capitalist project more broadly. We can think of work such as a recent book by Lale Khalili, or the work of economists Campling and Colas, or in anthropology, works such as that of Jatin Dua, Ashley Kars, or Laura Baer, for instance. And all these authors reveal, of course, how shipping routes, ships, containers, port infrastructures, and maritime workers play uneven parts in complex networks of seaborne trade and global logistics. And these are, of course, also questions that we've seen rising on the top of the agenda and also in public discourse recently, both in terms of the COVID pandemic and problems in supply chains and so on, and also with the Suez accident earlier this year. So while this history of containerization and so on, and its effect also on ports, is quite well documented in the literature, there is still, I think, work to do in terms of understanding how social life and place in itself is both constituted and constrained in the wake of modern global shipping. So at the center of these large-scale transformation lies the port as a kind of critical infrastructure for contemporary capitalism. So in this talk, or the remaining half an hour or 40 minutes that I have, I will take you to the port of Algeciras Bay, a container port at the borders of Europe, to look closer at how moving containers in this transport hub both feeds into and complicates understanding of economic and social futures. So I'll try and take you to some of the controversies and histories that form part of this port making and its role as a transshipment hub and a so-called strategic location at the Strait of Gibraltar. So this is where we are in Europe. We can see the very bottom of, if you follow my arrow here, this is the very southern end of Spain, and this is the town of Algeciras lying next to Gibraltar here. And you have Tangier across here, the Moroccan coast. So this is where we are. But I've somehow, perhaps a bit boldly, called my talk today cargo capitalism. And what do I refer to by saying cargo capitalism? I refer, of course, to the ways in which cargo travels the world's ocean entry infrastructures at the sea-land interface. So as a concept, cargo capitalism captures this global circulation of goods and its consequences for labor, place, and the environments. So this is very far from the Melanesian cargo cults that became famous through anthropological classics, but cargo is still a central feature of how to understand a contemporary economic life. And cargo capitalism is monitored by these cost-efficient logics of a booming logistics industry. And I also argue in other parts of my work that an anthropology of logistics also needs to be an anthropology where we connect these insights of global supply chains to topics of more classical anthropological interest, such as kinship, value creation, and local exchange practices. And we can get back to that later. And here we are with the containers again. But I thought I would take you to an office building in the outskirts of Algeciras, where I'm talking to a man called Miguel. And he's saying, we Europeans were used to putting Europe in the middle, but actually we're not. It is Singapore and Asia that should be here in the middle. So Miguel is in his late 50s, and he seemed kind of hardly able to breathe in between a very steady flow of words. But through the windows of an unflattering industrial office building in the outskirts of town, we can spot the ships passing the stretch of blue sea that is overlooked by the characteristic rock of Gibraltar. And what Miguel was doing was that he was busy showing me a rather kind of impressive replica map from the 1800s that covered the walls outside his office, and pointing his fingers at what he called the most important road in the world. To Miguel, there was little doubt that the Strait of Gibraltar holds what he called a natural strategic location. There are four important passages along this world road, he said. Four passes and one is ours. So turning his back to the map and watching the blue stretch of sea outside the windows, he continued to explain. 110,000 ships pass through the Strait of Gibraltar annually. That is our potential market. So potential capital then seems to flow through the Strait of Gibraltar in the mega ships of these multinational shipping companies that you can see on the photograph here that can carry anything from pineapple to fish to nails. And potential capital also seem to rest in the ships that lie anchored and shape this geographical landscape of the Bay of Algeciras, waiting, most of them, for their scheduled gap in the port terminals, where containers are unloaded, moved, cleared, temporarily stored, and reloaded, only to move on with another ship to its final destination. This is the logic of what is called transshipment. This means that containers are moved from these large vessels onto smaller feeder vessels that take the cargo to its final destination. So this port that I'm going to talk about is organized as many other ports. It's state-owned, governed by a public port authority, and through a form of landlord model, which means that infrastructure is leased out to multinational, often private companies, on kind of long-term leases that make investments in equipment and so on and so forth. And I'll get back to this. But to Miguel at the factory here that's showing me this replica map, for him and for many other residents in the port town of Algeciras, a risky future lies packed in these containers that are moved through the port. Because along these shores, where success and failure is measured in the number and weight of cargo mobility, maritime logistics contains both utopian and dystopian visions. So at this strait of seemingly endless possibilities, there are some asking, where will the containers go? Others are saying, will there be containers enough for all of us? And others again are saying, what have all of these containers ever done for us? So what is this port then that I'm talking about, and how did it come into being? This is the port and the center of town. This is Gibraltar here. And what you can't see on the photograph, but just here, is the Moroccan coast. So Algeciras' importance for maritime traffic stretches all the way back to Al-Andalus, when Berbers and Arabs reigned Spain for centuries and they first disembarked in this area. But after centuries of abandonment, it was not until the early 1900s that Spain actually started to build a new port infrastructure in this town that remained the same actually until the 1960s. And it was actually in the 1960s with the establishment of large industries in this area that we saw the large transformation of what is called not only Algeciras, but Campo de Gibraltar, which is the name of the whole area here. And the most escalating phase here was between the 1960s and the mid-1980s, because back in the 1960s, this area was characterized by what many researchers has termed a dependence economy with Gibraltar. And this was at the same time as this was being politically restructured under the Franco regime. So as we know, the Franco regime had heavy conflicts with the British government, and this also led to a sudden and very dramatic closure of the border in 1969. So Franco, he needed to make a plan for what to do with the Spanish border area. It was very poor. It had its lowest income level per capita in the whole of Spain. And the industry here lacked finance and was in general limited to the processing of fish and cork. And agriculture was very underexploited and technologically poor. So the Gibraltar economy here was essential, and it still actually is essential for many people. So back then it was 13,000 people that officially crossed the borders daily for work. But we can see the same numbers today as well, almost. So it was estimated back in the 1960s that up to 50,000 people was completely dependent on the Gibraltar economy. So during this period, Spain was in a period of industrialization, and this was combined with a very strong ideas of decentralization and development that had been growing in the central government. So in the mid-1960s then, the Spanish authorities gave life to a major development plan for this whole area, Campo de Gibraltar. And during the decade leading up to the mid-1970s, the state conceded economic help to improve particularly the industry. So they industrialized the entire Campo de Gibraltar. Heavy industries, including petrol refineries, chemical plants, and steelworks, settled in this area. And of course, these big industrial complexes were built at the seafront, And this facilitated the need for energy and the maritime transport of products. So parallel to this industrial development that we can see some witness of on this part of the coast, the bay of Algeciras' strategic oceanic location and natural qualities, protected deep waters, was noticed as ideal for port development. So with this economic and industrial development came also the start of an expansion of port infrastructures on areas that were created by filling up the sea. So since then, the port installations have exploited along the seafront all the way from the Gibraltar border, crossing Algeciras and all the way to other communities on the other side. So this eventually, of course, made the Port Authority into a proprietor of the whole coastline here, including five different communities in this area. And since then, the port has expanded on artificially created terrain. From 1975 to the late 80s, the port had actually filled as much as 140 hectares of sea. But during the decades that followed, up until 2020, when I was doing my fieldwork, this had become 700 hectares of sea. So that's about, that's around 1 million square meters of sea that's been taken to develop this port infrastructure, filling to give room for port installations. And of course, in terms of traffic, the port has grown with a similar velocity. In 2020, this port moved about 100 million tons of cargo on an annual basis. So much of this development that I'm describing here has been dependent on the so-called strategic location of Algeciras for multinational shipping companies. So Danish Maersk, which we all know here in the Nordic countries, is the world's largest shipping company, opened a new terminal here in the mid-1990s. And they selected this town by the Strait of Gibraltar as one of its important transshipment hub. So this means that 95% of the containers that comes to this port, they actually leave again by ship. So this is a strategic transfer point along the maritime routes that leads from Asia and the Middle East to the Mediterranean and North Europe, America. And during the 20 years that have followed Maersk's arrival, the boom in container traffic and the number of these container megaships that I started with here has continued to be referred to locally as a kind of gigantismo, a gigantism. So moving from fish to these forms of container giants in only a couple of decades, the port of Algeciras had become what Miguel in the office was calling an economic motor. But an expanding port has also started to increasingly eat larger parts of its host, which was the town and the bay. Because waste areas for cargo handling were needed, and as I said, also taken from the sea. And in 2010, the Spanish prince, Don Felipe, he came to Algeciras to inaugurate a new container terminal here. He was standing side by side with the president of the South Korean company, Hanjin Shipping, that had won the concession to run yet another container terminal in town. So with this container terminal, Algeciras had ensured the first semi-automatic container terminal in Southern Europe and the whole of Mediterranean area. And dock workers who started operating here, started working in this terminal in 2010, they can still remember how impressed they were by the technologically advanced equipment that occupied the docks and the patio. So for them, this was a new way of working, but also a dangerous step towards the automation that had made dock worker jobs obsolete in so many parts of the world already. So a 15 minutes drive away from Miguel's office, who was showing them me the map, at the maritime seafront of downtown Algeciras, the sea is actually hard to spot. between the massive areas of cemented port installations. So frequently referred to as one of Spain's ugliest towns, a combination of failed urbanistic projects and galloping port growth has left also the town of Algeciras with a troublesome relationship to its own port. Because Algeciras and the surrounding area still host the country's second largest industrial area. But even now, many decades after the historical developments that I talked about in the 60s, it also has some of Spain's highest unemployment rates. And when Algeciras reaches, this is one of the dock workers working in the port, if you're wondering what I'm showing you here. So when Algeciras reaches the national news, it is seldom because of the job that Leo, here, the dock worker here, is doing on the docks, but rather for a kind of thriving shadow economy, of a European frontier. The narcolanchas that are crossing the strait with hashish. We can see this very recently in a Netflix documentary that is still to be found on Netflix. Containers that are filled with cocaine hidden underneath bananas or inside pineapples, and also an extensive smuggling of cigarettes that is taking place across the border between Gibraltar and Spain. So the problem with drug traffic has led Spanish and international media to refer to this area as Europe's Medellin. And also the interior minister went as far a couple of years ago to call this part of Spain an underdeveloped area. So less visible in the Spanish media are these other forms of cargo traffic that is taking place in the port. And in this town with only about 20,000 inhabitants, the port had been calculated to generate as many as 30,000 jobs. But while the port was beating new records, it had also been only a few years since dock worker strikes had paralyzed the port for days and weeks, and a planned development of a third container terminal and expansion of the port had actually been put on hold due to these multinational investors' unwillingness to go in before the Spanish government had actually solved their labor issues. These forms of labor struggles could be referred to by theorists of logistics as friction from outside the logistical systems of cargo mobility, disrupting this form of imagined smoothness and efficiency. But these forms of disruptions also add to the more long-term speculation on the economic life and viability of a transshipment, and what in Algeciras is expressed as a viable fear of losing maritime control of the Strait of Gibraltar. And this takes us somewhere else. On a clear day, as this one, when I took this photograph, the massive cranes of Tangier Med Port, only 15 kilometers across the strait on the Moroccan coast, can be seen with clarity. And while the collaboration between these two ports is extensive in terms of moving passengers, cars, and trailers across the strait, the container cranes was causing worry on the Spanish coast. So while showing me the views from the control tower of the Port Authority, a guy called Luis, who was an employee at the Port Authority, he admitted that you know, we didn't really know that this port in Morocco would have such a capacity. And now that Maersk had established also on the other side of the strait in Morocco, they were controlling the whole strait, Luis said. But everything is uncertain, he added, feeding into a common discourse in the Algeciras port community, where the current times were described not only as uncertain, but also complicated or delicate. So here, contingencies were seen to have been put Algeciras in a form of predicament, guarding an uncertain future. The Strait of Gibraltar that we can watch on the photograph here has been called in other anthropological work and geographical work a choke point. Sites where the flows upon which contemporary life depends are constricted or choked, and that contains both obstacles and opportunities, as Ashley Carse and his colleagues has put it. So the Strait of Gibraltar then has given Algeciras an entering and stopping point, an advantage along these global maritime routes. There is almost zero detour and thus less cost for these shipping companies. So if explain it more simply, the logic is that every minute a ship is anchored in a transshipment port, it implies a cost for the shipping line because the client only pays for the transport from origin to destination. But transshipment also means that the cargo handling can be done in any port with the same capacity and strategic location where costs and risk are minimized. And this, of course, became clear during the massive labor unrest in 2017, where many shipping companies just decided to take the traffic elsewhere. So while Luis at the Port Authority was showing me the commercial predictions for traffic at the Strait of Gibraltar, together with one of the manager at the Korean run terminal, he was saying, you know, we're really waiting to see what's going on in Tangier here, whether it will actually increase our capacity as well. We're in a critical phase. But actually, they had been in a critical phase all the way back when the Korean-owned Hanjin Shipping won the bid to develop and run this terminal. They knew that they had competition on the North African coast. We had in front of support with salaries and labor costs seven times less than in Europe. And the result of the analysis was to build a semi-automatic terminal, reducing labor costs and thus offering less jobs to the town's dock workers. So containers here are moved at high speed at the port of Algeciras through the Strait of Gibraltar. But the numbers they arrive in and the directions they take are dependent upon a global container economy and the strategies of multinational shipping companies. And here, the geographically strategic location that has allowed for the port to economically grow through a global transshipment system has shown to be also the very system that produces these eventualities and contingencies that jeopardize the port's very own future. So this photograph is taken on the second floor of the building that hosts the public port authority in Algeciras. And the map we can see here is a very different map than the one Miguel showed me at the factory. It shows the more than 200 direct maritime connections that the port holds with other ports world over. The map is impressive and leaves Algeciras top 10 in the ranking of ports in terms of maritime connections. In Algeciras, this strategic geographical connection with maritime links world over stands in deep contrast, however, to the geographical isolation as Europe's final outpost, or as some locals would put it quite bluntly, this is almost Africa. So speculation on the future of Algeciras inside and outside the port, from concrete plans of port expansion to everyday talk on the street, would often center on this political abandonment on the area. And this was an abandonment, according to locals, that had cost Spain's largest port, with this more than 200 maritime connection points, to be operated without a modern electrified railway connection to its own port capital. So the two maps that I'm showing you, this one and the next one, are maps that are showing the European Union's rail freight corridors, the Atlantic and the Mediterranean corridors, that are supposed to start and end in Algeciras. This is one starting here, and on the other one, it's supposed to start here. This has so far remained an unfulfilled political promise. Algeciras and the surrounding area has for a century relied on a railway infrastructure that was established as a colonial project by the English in the late 1880s. That was actually the aim of connecting Gibraltar with other parts of Europe. This is a railway infrastructure, as you can see on the photograph here, after a heavy storm during my fieldwork, that lacks proper electrification. So local protests in Algeciras would usually take place as a form of larger political critique of abandonment of Spain's southern periphery. Speculative endeavors from actors inside the port community would point to the economic and entrepreneurial power of other regions with big ports whose lobbying pressures on the Spanish government had resulted in the neglect of Algeciras' very much needed European railway connections. And this was threatening, as they said, the country's largest port with a slow death. So this discourse of political abandonment on national level stands in contrast, however, to local disagreements concerning the port's role in the future of the area. In Algeciras, it is common to hear the major infrastructure in the town being referred to not as a motor, as Miguel would put it, but rather as a monster which had eaten the seafront and which was constantly noisy and visible. Or as a woman that I talked to, who was in her 60s, put it, that monster we have in front of us and that don't give us anything, que no nos da nada. So the hungry monster eating of the seafront was a major point of frustration, guided by a nostalgia of the lost town and a rage towards the concreted bay. We can see this, how it takes form in different Facebook forums, for instance, where you can see photographs of the Algeciras that used to be and the Algeciras that is of now, where the sea has completely disappeared from all of the photographs and which is left is concrete. So, so this nostalgia of the lost town and the rage towards the this concreted bay was also adding to a more complicated discourse of what could actually generate in terms of employment and development in Algeciras and the neighboring community. So here the dock workers would be portrayed as the group of workers that had greatly benefited from the port development, but that these forms of benefits had yet to reach other people of the area. So these observations about the port's unfulfilled promise of development raises, of course, the questions of what happens when production moves out at sea and behind the securitized walls of cargo infrastructure, such as the one we can see in this photograph. During more than the first half of the 20th century, the town of Algeciras had a strong maritime identity, hosting a major fishing town. But with the arrival of cargo capitalism and the rapid expansion of the port, what was cemented was not only the bay, but also the separation of town and the port. This is not a tale that is unique to Algeciras, of course. As links between sea and land and location for trade and transit, we can think of the port as a place that has figured in literature and in film as a place of particular characteristics, right? We can think of bustling mercantile activities, visiting seafarers, drifting travelers, busy markets, pubs, prostitutes. But port cities' romanticized association with moving goods and people has throughout history been also closely attached to the semi-illegal spheres of exchange with smuggled goods of different sorts. And central to these representations are the dubious figures of the port city, for whom the liminal space between the sea and land has offered ways of living and being. But in this context of cargo capitalism, the ports that have been produced are of another nature. Usually, they are located in the outskirts of large cities with waste terminal areas and advanced securitization regimes. And this is what is unique to Algeciras, however, because here what we find is a sort of curious lack of correspondence in size between the port and the town. The port of Algeciras Bay is a very big port in the midst of a rather small town. So before ending, I thought I would return to Miguel's office at the factory, where he seemed very confident that the port was not the monster, but actually the motor for development of this area, feeding 30,000 families through the containers it moves, as he would put it. But the brutal port competition worried him, and he saw the risks of transshipment. We need a train, he said. If not, the port will die, and just think about the unemployment it will produce. So as the so-called transshipment hub then, at the borders of Europe, this port contributes to keeping the world's goods in motion. In the port community, the way I've described it, incompatible predictions circulate, where port expansion and a bright freight future meets dystopic visions of a port isolated from Europe with an inferior railway and fierce competitors in the Mediterranean Sea. So for many company owners and workers in Algeciras logistical industries, the future is freight, but risks lie embedded in the cargo that only passes in containers through the port without, at least in theory, entering Europe. So the logics of maritime logistics, as this case illustrates them, contains and mediates relation between different forms of future. And the port town here is one of competing realities of connection and disconnection, because its strategic location by a strait that is portrayed as a strait of possibilities is finally about the experience and value of location that navigates alongside ephemeral shipping routes and the rise and fall of maritime infrastructures. So I think I'll end here and say thank you, and then I look forward to your questions, comments. I will stop sharing my screen.
Thank you very much indeed. I personally found that